Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. When Orson Welles died in 1985, he left behind a body of work that ranked him as one of the greatest filmmakers of all time, despite the fact that he had finished his last film almost 3 decades before, and his later years were marked by a sense of early promise unfulfilled. Frank Beecham worked with Welles in the last year of his life, and now he's co-written a play about that time with George Dimas, who also co-directs and stars as Welles. The play is called Maverick, and it's on stage at the Connolly Theater in the East Village until March 2nd. I'm delighted it has brought Frank Beecham and George Dimas to our show now. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Frank, you worked with Welles as on one of his last unfinished projects. That was over 30 years ago. What led you to write about that now? Although you've done some other things in the intervening years.
Yeah. No. What happened was that George and I really began to do work on this about 18 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And it was interesting. George was doing a play about Dorothy Parker. And I had mentioned to him and a couple of people after the show that Orson had gotten Lucille Ball to do Dorothy's stuff on radio. And the whole question came up, and one of the theater directors there suggested we write something. Mm-hmm. And we did. And this is the way it came out.
And you found the collaboration worked well for both of you, because that's the hardest thing
wonderful.
To pull off.
It's been wonderful. George has nailed Orson to a point that is eerie for me.
Yeah, George, your performance of Welles feels spot on. Did you ever meet him?
Orson Welles?
Yeah, except in the movies?
Oh, no, I only know him through recordings and YouTube and, of course, Citizen Kane and the films he did.
How do you approach playing a man who's so recognizable, especially the voice?
You bear
a physical resemblance some degree.
I'm lucky in the fact that a lot of times when you play a figure that's well known, there's not a lot of material on them speaking extemporaneously like you would if, you know, but there's so much of it on Welles, so you really can get a sense of him as a person and his cadences, the pace of his thinking is certainly something that's hard to keep up with. But there's a lot out there to look at and to you kind of bite into the things that you identify with and feel that you can convey.
Was getting that voice right the key to the perform, a major key to the perform?
Well, I mean, I made it clear to the company of what we're doing that we're not doing Night of a Thousand Voices here, but that we wanted these characters to be seasoned with the essence of them.
Frank, how did you meet Orson Welles? How old were you at the time?
I was 35. I was doing Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous in Hollywood.
You were doing. You were producing the show?
I was not producing, but I did all the production. I had a facility there that was based on the Betacam that Sony had built for us, and it was the only facility that could do the show economically enough. And so what happened was Welles found out that we were working on this through one of my freelance editors. And one day I get a call from the voice of God would I like to have lunch with him? And this is how it all began.
That must have been a shock, because I assumed that you had ambitions to do more than work on Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous.
Oh, well, that's exactly, and it's a core of what the play is about. Is I had one foot in the Lifestyles thing with Robin Leach and the other foot in a creative nirvana with Orson Welles, and I'm being pulled apart. And Welles won.
Frank, can I mention the Cradle Will Rock and vis-a-vis how sure. Orson. Well, one salient fact that was missed in what Frank was saying was that Frank was not happy. Frank was executive producer of the Tim Robbins film Cradle Will Rock, and he was not happy with how Wells was treated or portrayed in that film ultimately. And you were on contract with Disney. You couldn't say anything bad about the movie. And so Frank's idea of revisionism was to write a play to kind of hopefully set
that's
the record
true.
Straight.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that Betacam. Was that the first handheld video camera recorder?
That was. We had serial number 3. I'd gotten it from Sony. They had no purpose for it at the time. It weighed about 30 pounds. And if you can think of a – it sounded lightweight at the time because it was – today, an iPhone performs better, but we wanted to do entertainment with it, and it had been invented for news. And I went to Sony, and I said, look, we could do this, but you got to build me a room that'll work. And they did. And I come up with $75,000, and they give me a $1 million edit bay, and that's how we did it.
Although at that time you couldn't have imagined that a smartphone could do all those things.
No, you couldn't. But it was pretty amazing that the Betacam could. And it's interesting, we have an original Betacam in the play. And that Betacam I got on eBay for like $100. And they're impossible to find. If something were to happen to it, we'd be dead.
In a character, the point is made in the play that the new technology is great because it's so cheap that it'll democratize filmmaking.
That was my naive view at the time.
But then Wells says that making filmmaking so accessible might not be a good thing because you might not like what you see.
Well, as in most things that Orson said at the time, he was dead on right. I was naive. I got into video because I thought it would change the world. I thought that it would democratize video, and I thought that'd be a good thing. Now I don't believe that anymore.
Well, we get some wonderful stuff.
Because
people just will film things that they are witnessing on the highway or elsewhere that we would not know about otherwise.
That's true, and it's had its... You know, it's like one of these things that cuts both ways.
Yeah, and the flip side, you get reality TV, mm-hmm. which would not be financially producible.
Yeah, and also, I was one of the forefathers or forefounders of that, and that was one of the things I didn't like.
You still feeling guilty about it?
Yeah, I do. You know, if people say, I remember your credit on that show, and I it always bothers me. That's a legacy.
Although Wells was highly respected as a director, did his films ever make any money?
Well, Citizen Kane has.
But it didn't initially. In fact,
it took 7 years.
Well, it didn't help that William Randolph Hearst forbade all of his newspapers from running ads for the film.
Mm. No, it never made money initially, but it's made a lot of money over the years. I would say most of Wells' films have not made a lot of money. Most of them are artistic successes, like F for Fake is one of the best documentaries ever made. And, of course, his radio and his theater stuff. I mean, the man was an inventor. You have to look at these films for what they broke at the time that had never been done before. That's the critical way to watch a Wells film. I just sent George a thing yesterday about some young person had picked the 5 best Wells films and picked Transformers one of them. I mean, Wells would be rolling in his grave if he ever heard that. It's terrible.
But he did make some wonderful films, although he always had problems with Hollywood. The Magnificent Ambersons, which we can only guess. Well, hasn't a new cut been made that was what he wanted?
But the studio really messed it up. Well, what happened with Ambersons is that they lost, the footage was destroyed. Wells was sent to do a show called It's All True in Latin America by Nelson Rockefeller, of all people. And they recut Ambersons when he was gone, and then the footage was lost. So Ambersons has never been what Wells wanted, and it was an interesting story that Oya Kodar, his mistress in the home where he died, said that Wells would occasionally see the film, it'd come on television, and he would weep watching it. I mean, it really upset him.
It is amazing that he made so many great films, and the only people who really appreciate them are film buffs.
Well, you know, that's the difficulty of a great director. When you study Welles and you look at what he did that was never done before he did it, it becomes incredible. I mean, what he did in with War of the Worlds, for example, he saw radio as a symphony conductor, and he would stand on a podium and treat it like an orchestra, and he would mix the actors, the music, and the sound effects, and do it on the fly. And it was really amazing how he did that.
And, of course, War of the Worlds is one of the legendary radio broadcasts because it sent many people into a panic.
It did, but what was unique,
it was done that realistically? That they really believed that we were being invaded by Martians?
Absolutely, it did. But what's interesting is the afternoon that the show was done, they did a rehearsal in which Welles said it's one of the worst pieces the Mercury had ever done. That night, they were in a bar. Welles said, let's stretch, put dead air in what was a no-no at the time. You had to have tight production. He made it, dragged it out, and that gave it attention.
And it's one of those instances where Welles was able to take total disaster and turn it around and make it a total triumph. I mean, he also did.
Right. He did that all the time.
Yeah.
I mean,
did that make him famous? I mean, he was already well known, but that was a major news story.
It was. But he had already scored with the Mercury Theater. He was doing things like putting live microphones in restrooms in order to get the sewers of Paris, you know, the ambience. He took a rifle and fired it off the roof of a building in New York City and put it on the air. He did things that nobody was doing. I mean, it was really remarkable.
Did the new technology of video appeal to him because it was less expensive than films? Because with video,
you
don't have to buy film stock. You don't have to pay for processing.
That
although
was
the quality wasn't as great at the time.
He didn't care about the quality. He was somebody who said he was an amateur at heart. He felt that the image could be made with any kind of palette. You just had to choose what you wanted to do with it. So it didn't matter to him.
And I think he had also seen, like in the year we're dealing with, mostly 1985, that 2 years prior, Olivier had done a very successful King Lear on video. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, those were the big cameras that had studio cameras, but I think he saw that there was a lot that he could do with Lear and the type of material he wanted to do with video.
One of the other things that makes it different is it's immediate because you can see the results instantly.
Oh, yeah. He saw the Betacam as an Aeroflex without film. And that's the way he saw video. He liked the immediacy. He didn't want to pay for the film stock. He felt that, in a way, video freed him from the constraints of the budget counters, and he called them the bean counters. Mm-hmm. And what appealed to me was, hey, Orson Welles had reinvented radio, theater, film. He might reinvent video, and I'll be there with him. And that was what was exciting to me.
We could only imagine what might have actually happened.
Oh, yeah. No, I think about it all the time. If Welles had lived, say, 20 years longer, and he could have worked with small format video gear, he's liable to have done some of his best work. We don't know. He dies the night before we just start at my typewriter with my script in it. And it was really a terrible thing. I mean, it was a total loss. We never got anything.
He had been ill, right? But he had a heart attack. He's only 70 years old at the time.
Yeah, I know. And we didn't know he was ill. He had told me that he couldn't eat, he couldn't drink and eat rich foods. I mean, he was eating. He was insisting that I eat for him. But I never sensed that he was near death. Never.
I'm speaking with Frank Beecham and George Dimas about Orson Welles. They have co-written a play called Maverick, which is currently on stage at the Connolly Theater at 220 East 4th Street in the East Village. Only a few more weeks. It runs until March 2nd.
March 2nd, yeah.
And this is Leonard Lopate at Large at WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM. I'm Leonard Lopate. So let's talk about that meeting, your first meeting with Welles. He insisted that you drink wine, even though he could no longer drink wine. And then he ordered you the warm lobster salad because he thinks you had to experience it. That really happened.
That sounds
like a control freak.
Yeah, well, he was. He also had his little dog, Cheeky, there, who bit me, and he bites me in the play.
And you had to train the dog to bite? You like being bitten every night?
No, actually, George and Orson laughed when Cheeky bit me because he thought it was funny, and it was my first flavor of Orson's humor. I realized that, you know, I couldn't kick the dog. You can't hit Orson Welles' dog, so you just have to endure the pain. And it wasn't that big a deal, but when he laughed, I thought, wow, that's now we got an interesting guy here.
So did you like the lobster salad?
Yeah, the lobster salad was really quite good. I never thought about food when I was eating with Orson. Orson, you had to be on your toes when you ate with Orson. He was a guy who didn't want to hear any bull. He didn't want to have a conversation in a light way. However, I think the reason I hit it off with him was I didn't know much about him in the beginning, except radio, because I'd come from radio. And we really bonded over the radio because he thought it was the best, most creative work he ever did because there wasn't much money in it. And that's what he loved.
Well, the other thing that makes radio wonderful and the thing that I miss most about the radio dramas of my youth is your imagination fills in all the details.
Absolutely.
And with film and with television, everything is laid out for you.
He called it the theater of the imagination.
So what was the first project you worked on with him?
Well, the one that we worked on was the one that took a year, and that was the one in the play. It was to be called Orson Welles Solo. It was a magic show, and Orson had done films after World War II where he sawed Rita Hayworth in half. And he was going to use some of those clips along with new footage that he did, and he was going to float a human body over the audience, and he was going to do all these things. And he kept escalating the budget, which put pressure on me to raise money for him. And needless to say, I didn't have the money until the last moment. But I had to keep telling Orson I did because he would walk away if I didn't.
So he wanted to film a live magic show that was done at the UCLA Theater.
Right, and he wanted the beta cams to float around the room and be able to intercut with them. They didn't quite work at the time, and I had Sony coming in with their engineers to try to ensure that it did work. And it was, it was a wild roller coaster. I didn't have the money. I didn't know if the technology would work, but I was not going to say no to Orson Welles.
Was raising the money made more difficult by the fact that Welles refused to release scripts or allow investors to visit sets?
Oh, yeah. No, Orson would not give any of us a script. HBO had offered him the money, and he said, no, they're a bunch of bean counters. I don't want them there. I want you. Now, the reason he wanted me is he could control me. I knew this. But and I had learned this whole concept of being a slave because I knew from John Houseman that, you know, how it turns out, you know.
Well, you had spoken to John Houseman about working with Orson Welles.
Oh, yeah. No, I had spoken to John Houseman, and I, in fact, had made a mistake of giving Houseman a script that Orson wrote, of which Houseman was furious. So I got caught in the middle out of being purely too naive. However, I did know, I was very aware that I was being used, but I was going to go anyway because I wanted to be on his train and the roller coaster.
An early scene shows you going to a bank to request a line of credit. Were there many banks willing to lend money to Wells?
No, no one would. But it was it's kind of a thing to show that, you know, there's no way. Because I had no collateral. I didn't know what the script was. I didn't know anything. I didn't know what the show was. I mean, it was absurd.
Also, on a dramaturgical level, it's quite convenient to have a character interviewing for a bank loan to get certain information out there.
Yes. Well, you use flashbacks as a way of telling the story.
Yeah. Now, Orson told me at lunch one day that Picasso had done could do a painting that basically he'd get $4 million for and not have to tell anybody what it would be.
In advance, he would get the money.
Right, he'd get the money in advance. And Orson always thought he was equal to Picasso. He knew him and all of this. And he said, why can't I have this money? And that's the pitch I used to actually raise the money, which was absurd, but it worked.
On the other hand, Orson Welles was one of the greatest filmmakers of all time. You would have thought that people would have appreciated that.
Well,
weren't there any fans out there who had money?
Well, today, with social media, probably. He could be raising money online. But there was no social media then. In fact, he tried to get money from other directors who would have lunch with him and want to appeal to his, you know, they wanted to know things that would interest them, but they didn't want to give him any money or help him get money.
I mean, one of the things is that the resource that these people have is money. The resource they don't have is time. And probably working with Welles would promise to be a pretty big time suck, and I think maybe that was part of the reason.
Even if you worked in video and that shortened the time.
Yeah.
He also wanted to do a King Lear?
King Lear. He was trying to do King Lear, and he did a pitch tape for directors.
He would have been a great Lear.
He would have, yeah. But at that stage of his life, nobody wanted to touch him. He really had become so polarized about the funding and producers and money that this is what prohibited a lot of people from taking him seriously. Now, I will tell you that I think it was Steven Spielberg that bought the sled from Citizen Kane as a prop for $75,000. Because I told him at lunch one day, I showed him the trades, and he got so upset about that because he felt that here people would give money for a prop from an old film, but they wouldn't give it to him as a living director.
And it's weird because Rosebud, everybody knows what Rosebud means. Because he becomes such an important part of the popular culture,
right,
despite the fact that he had all these problems.
Right. No, he was a mixed bag, let's say that.
Well, with Citizen Kane, and I don't know if a lot of people know this, but the heads of all the studios, not just RKO, all of them met in New York. And this is verified by Robert Wise, who was an editor and also became
pretty
head
good
of
director.
Them. Yeah. That they all met to decide whether to release Citizen Kane or not. And Robert Wise says that the greatest performance Welles ever gave was in his speech to these studio heads about releasing the movie. They ultimately decided to do it, but I have a feeling that it was not the last time that group of people got together about the threat that he posed potentially to the business.
But that was because they were afraid of William Randolph Hearst.
Yes, and they couldn't get their films advertised.
He was one of the most powerful newspaper publishers in the country, and he could have gotten revenge for all of the films that they wanted to release from then on.
Sure, but they were in a sticky place because Welles had such a contract and had such control over the post-production that you could say, yeah, we'll give him the movie and he can burn it. But they wouldn't know that Welles didn't necessarily have another copy because it was so secretive, so closed from his contract that he could have had another copy of the film.
One of the scenes shows him speaking with a reporter who's surprised to learn that Welles is from Kenosha, Wisconsin. Yeah, we don't think of him as somebody from Wisconsin, but wasn't he also involved in politics in Wisconsin?
Oh, yeah. He ran he thought of running for the U.S. Senate. He was involved in politics even back to the point he wrote a number of Roosevelt's fireside chats. They wanted him to run for the U.S. Senate from Wisconsin, and he decided not to. But Joseph McCarthy, the senator, got elected. There's a wonderful bit in the play where Orson says, well, you know, they wanted me to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee. And I asked him to let me do it. I said, get as many cameras there as you can, because I really want to tell the nation what's going on here. And, of course, McCarthy doesn't ask him because he's afraid of Orson. Mm-hmm. So it's Orson probably would have had a great career in politics if he hadn't hadn't had the temperament he had.
He had a
and
political
we might have been
column.
Spared Joseph McCarthy.
He had a political column for the Post, but was fired in kind of that 6 month period when anybody to the left was fired.
And he also did a lot of political commentary.
Well, by the way, we should point out that the New York Post in those days was considered a very liberal newspaper.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. It was, until Rupert Murdoch bought it. In fact, it was pretty much a liberal newspaper. It was the leftist newspaper, as opposed to the news had gone from supporter of FDR to opponent, and then we had the Trib, which was a Republican newspaper, and then there were the Hearst Papers, Journal, and the Journal American. So the Post was the paper that all of the liberals read.
Yes, well, he talked about in this. I don't
in fact,
know if
Eleanor Roosevelt had a column in it.
Oh, well, no, he was fired from it when everybody to the left was fired, and just didn't go back to it. It didn't spark his interest.
His family, his parents died when he was a child, but his mother was a concert pianist. She died when he was 9, and his father was an inventor, and he died when Wells was 15. So did that give him the freedom to reinvent himself?
Well, he went to a school called the Todd School for Boys and started doing Shakespeare there. And Roger Hill, who was a teacher, encouraged him. And he went on to go to England and be with a major theater company there.
It was Ireland.
Ireland, yeah. I'm sorry, yeah. And he grew a beard. He smoked a cigar to look older. And he just dived right in, and he wrote a book about Shakespeare when he was a kid. I mean, he just – I think everyone saw him as a prodigy and who was a genius in his early days. And he was a genius. I mean, you look at what he did before he was 30 years old, it's amazing.
But he really makes his name in radio. Did he give up the theater?
Well, no. He did radio first, but he was doing theater simultaneously. When he was fired from radio, which came when he did Cradle of Rock, the play that the government tried to shut down, he and Mark Blitzstein went away. They created a name, the Mercury Theater of the Air. He went on to do that. That's where War of the Worlds came. And from that, it's interesting, John Houseman told me a story that he said he figured that when Wells sold Martian's Landing to the mass audience, that Campbell's Soup Company figured he could sell people on Campbell's Chicken Soup. And that's how he got the contract in Hollywood. It went on, and Campbell's Soup sponsored him, and he went on to have a big career.
He had a joke that in South America they tried to do the same thing with Martian's Landing, and the people were sent to prison. But when he did it, he was sent to Hollywood.
That was 1938 when he did that show.
Right, right.
But you include flashbacks to his time working with Houseman, and it shows Wells being rather abusive.
He was very abusive to Houseman. In fact,
even as a young man, he was kind of demanding.
Their relationship ended in a restaurant called Chasen's in Hollywood. When Orson set the curtains on fire, throwing cans of Sterno at Houseman, and that's when they ended the relationship. It was turbulent. Houseman, when he was younger, felt that he was latching on to a creative genius, which he was. But as they got older, they just went different paths. And Houseman really hated the fact that Wells had, you know, taken a lot of credit from him. But it was interesting because Wells figured that when Houseman wrote all of his books about their relationship, that Houseman was defining history. And he couldn't write a book. And the reason he couldn't write a book is he sold it so many times that he couldn't write it. He'd be sued. He was in a bind. A lot of his situations were hilarious in a certain way.
I interviewed John Houseman not long before he died, and my memories of him are as a very nice person, but you never know. People are on their best behavior when they come on a radio show.
Right.
George, you portray Wells as rude and dismissive toward the people he worked with in general, but then he turns on a dime and becomes charming and self-deprecating. Did that usually work for him?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I know in this documentary, They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, which is out right now, that people would talk about how you would be driven to the point with him, working with him, that you would say, listen, fat guy, you can take your project and put it where the sun don't shine. And when you were just about to do that, you would feel his arm draping around your shoulder, and he would say, have I told you about what a good job you're doing for me? And he just knew how to push people to the limit and calibrate all of that so he could...
And the charm he could turn on was unbelievable.
You can only wonder what he would have been like in the era of Netflix, which is showing that documentary about him.
Yes, yes. I mean, and what he could have done with an iPhone.
Frank Beecham and George Dimas, who are the co-writers of a play called Maverick, which is on stage at the Connolly Theater in the East Village until March 2nd. Mr. Dimas is also the co-director, and he stars as well. You're the only actor in the play who plays only one character.
Correct. Well, the actor who plays Frank, Stephen Pilkington, he plays Frank and John Houseman. And then beyond that, there's people who play many characters because it's structured as Frank recollecting his memories of Wells and everybody, including Wells, except Frank, everybody including Orson Welles is dressed in gray, and we put on one or two costume items to represent the people that we're playing.
The Frank we see in the play is always at Wells' beck and call, even when the call is at 3 o'clock in the morning. Did you feel that whatever Wells asked you, you had to say yes to?
Well, what I was constantly being tested. That 3 o'clock call, and anyone that knows about the old radio, when you edited reel-to-reel tape with a razor blade, if it was magnetized, it would cause a pop. Well, that was fairly amateur stuff, but Wells calls me with this seeming problem at 3 o'clock in the morning. I knew that a man that had practically invented radio would know this, but he was testing me to see if I knew it. And I realized it immediately, but this is what he would do. He would try to tease you to see what you knew or didn't know.
He sounds like a real piece of work.
Oh, he was a piece of
work. Do you think he got worse as he got older?
No, actually, it was interesting because he wanted, when he got into video in a big way. He's 70 years old. But I took him to a place called Synclavier, which was one of the first audio editing systems. It was also music. But he was listening to a broken wine glass, and he said, wait a minute, you guys don't quite have that right. He would question people beyond their belief, and they didn't know that that this would happen. So it was really a guy who wanted his own video editing system. He wanted all of these things that were really expensive, but he was out there. He was ahead of his time.
And that's a thread that runs through the play, Wells requesting outrageous stunts and technical tricks that the budgets couldn't support.
Well, he just always wanted me to raise more money. It was like this trick that he was going to do to put people over the heads of the audience. He had Doug Henning's magic designer do it, and he wanted $35,000. And he said, Frank, get it.
How good was he as a magician?
Oh, he was good. He would play at the Magic Castle, and he would he had a He loved to do it.
He learned it as a kid. He said when other kids had violin lessons, I learned card tricks because his father gave him magic lessons when he was a boy.
But you didn't have to learn how to do magic to play him, did you?
No. I mean, I would have loved to have done that, but we really wanted to do it right. We were going to do it, but we didn't have the time or the money.
Is it true that he hired an ambulance to take him from place to place because he wouldn't have to stop for red lights?
He said wow. It with things like a great line, which we have in the play, is art should never be have to stop for a red light. And he did that. And I always felt he told me that story with great glee.
Because you never were in the ambulance with him.
Oh, no. Because it was back, this was in the radio days. Uh-huh. And the way he would get from a theater rehearsal to a radio show, which was, he would just hit it at the very moment that it was about to start, is he would use an ambulance, and he found out there was no law against it. The other thing that he would do, he would go into the radio studio, and he would usually take a fake script, and to scare everyone, he would drop the script on the floor as the show was about to start, and then he would pull out his real script. And he would absolutely scare those producers to death.
Do you think he was self-sabotaging or simply always just wanted to push the envelope?
I think it was an ego thing that he enjoyed pushing the envelope in the radio days.
Yeah. I think also he thrived on chaos and that he felt that he could perform well in a chaotic circumstance and kind of get the upper hand.
No question. I mean, that the way with War of the Worlds, when you look at that, it was the chaos that created the winning show. It was never planned.
There's a scene of a young director named Nicholas having lunch with Wells, and he has made a science fiction film about a space urchin who wants to go home. I'm assuming that's based on Steven Spielberg.
And so it's a number of people.
Oh,
okay. Yeah, I mean, that became a motif. John Carpenter did a movie about that. Nicholas Rogue did a movie about that. So it's an amalgam of people, and that character is meant to represent the kind of sycophantic director that loved to talk to Wells at lunch but wouldn't help him out.
Yeah, because that character calls Wells his hero but then refuses to help him or even take his phone calls.
Oh yeah, well that happened.
Did they see
to him
as a
lot.
Nuisance?
Yeah, they saw him as a way to have a lunch with a historic figure, but they weren't going to help him, and that happened over and over to him.
Did they pick up the tab because he ate at expensive restaurants and, as you said, pampered his pet dog?
That's a funny story.
But you were scrambling to raise money for his projects at the same time.
I was. What was interesting was the guy that an editor that worked for me freelance had insisted that I pick up the tab always at Wells lunches. And I tried to. But the voice of God said, no, you won't. And I could not. I couldn't do it the way he was so forceful about it. And finally, there's a scene where he slams his fist on the table and he says, do you have the money? And I realized at that very moment, if I were going to be a producer, I would have to lie. Hmm. And I did. I lied. I said, yes, I have the money. That day, he let me pick up the tab. So it was interesting.
Wells died while he was working on the final scene of your project. The night before you would begin filming. So what happened to the project? Was it just canceled?
Yeah, I got a phone call the next morning from Wells' enforcer, a guy named Alessandro Tosca, who was a count that had produced one of his shows in Europe. And he said to me simply, the project has been canceled.
Well, you worked with him for less than a year.
Right.
This play covers pretty much the last months of his life. But did you consider it a formative experience?
Oh, it was life-changing.
Because you were turning down other jobs to concentrate on
Wells'
project.
Oh, yeah, no. Look, John Houseman said, and he was so right, when you have been touched by a real genius, not the phony ones that people say are geniuses, but when you've been touched by a real genius, it changes your life. It definitely changed my life, no question about it. Now, Wells had told me the story one day of Cradle Will Rock. And he said to me that if I can't produce it, you should consider producing it. And he even said, you shall. And when it was over, that lunch was over, and he died only a month or two later, I realized I had to do it. I had to do something.
And you got Tim Robbins to do it with you.
I gave the project to Tim Robbins. We worked together on it for, oh, gosh, it went 15 years. But I also did Theater of the Imagination. Wells' people all came out and started to befriend me. I did his memorial service, which we've now got online, has not been seen in 35 years. I did Theater of the Imagination, which he had left all of his old radio material in a cardboard box in the garage of one of his employees. So it went on and on. And
One of the surprises was he says more than once that professionalism isn't always the most important thing.
It's not. Not to him.
Well, I think you have to look at the way he was saying it. By professional, he meant being devoted to the occupation. And when he says he's devoted to the amateur approach, it's from the Latin root of the word, which is amor, for the love of it. And that's what he meant by that, not by being frayed at the edges, but by doing things with your heart.
In this play, you have actors moving the sets, sometimes breaking the fourth wall by speaking directly to the audience. Were you trying to incorporate a sense of experimentation in your scene?
Absolutely. I mean, I think when we did this, we wanted to do something that was not your kind of standard issue bio play, but something that Wells himself might get a kick out of seeing. And it borrows a little bit from some of his funkier work that he did later in his life, like F for Fake and Other Side of the Wind and things like that.
You have a company of six actors, all except you, playing more than one role. Mm-hmm. Everyone from cameraman and reporters to celebrities like Robin Leach, Zsa Zsa Gabor, and Merv Griffin. Is that a challenge that most actors welcome?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's something where, you know, we just jump in, and it's part of the joy of this kind of a more imaginative approach to that simply someone puts on a hat and they assert by force of will, I am this person. And if they believe it, we hope the audience goes along on the ride with them. And it's really about confidently, you know, striding into the role and adopting it immediately and with confidence.
There are some shocking moments. Wells isn't the only one who acts out. Mac Mundy's portrayal of Robin Leach shows the lifestyles of the rich and famous host snorting cocaine and even grabbing a female engineer at a recording session. Is that based on your experiences with him?
Exactly. It is.
Wow.
Robin once asked me to get some cocaine that he had left in the back of a cab. And I refused because I wasn't going to go down for him. But no, he was an interesting cat. And I had one foot. I always kind of felt I had one foot in the sewer and another in Nirvana because I was just torn between these two forces. And he was not a fun guy to work for, I must say.
Well, he also, too, the offices of Television Matrix, Frank's company, was on a lot where they shot soap operas, and didn't he promise some soap opera actress that she could be on the show and asked you to interview her? And
yeah,
it was all nonsense.
End up interviewing the soap opera actresses that he was trying to have an affair with, and the tapes would always go on the shelf somewhere in the back because he never intended to let them
There was a snarky side of him on that show, so I always felt a little uncomfortable. Maybe he just couldn't hide who he really was.
No, he didn't hide it. That's him. And I think up until he died, you know, it was that
big,
was him.
Big Trump fan. He was a commentator for Fox News.
Was Touch of Evil his last story film? Wells' last story film?
It was the last film done by a studio.
Now, it's a masterpiece.
Oh, it is a masterpiece.
And yet he didn't get any projects after that. He had a long career as an actor. He did narrations. He did commercials, I guess, to pay the bills. But no more studio films.
The reason the studio felt it was too highbrow. He kept him out of it. He edited it to the end. And we have a scene in the story about this producer, Ed Mule, Ed Mull. I'm sorry. We've now learned the pronunciation of his name. He, you know, he basically said that a number of producers had lost their jobs, giving Wells that creative freedom during the Citizen Kane era, and he wasn't going to lose his.
And there was not a contract like Wells's in terms of creative control before him nor after. And I'm sure that, and I was talking earlier about the studio heads getting together, I'm sure that it was an industry maxim not to give anyone that kind of creative control again.
And one more thing that George didn't say is he wrote a 58-page memo that became the new film that we see today. So the film that has been re-edited to Wells' original plan came from what he did afterwards. So it has been restored, unlike Magnificent Ambersons.
He made other films, but not through the studios, and he did pitch tapes for investors. Was this something that he came up with?
Yeah, he wanted people to finance his films. And I mean, he tried to do Cradle of Rock, and the money fell apart. In all the cases, people just he could never hold it together.
His last film, The Other Side of the Wind, was released just last year, more than 30 years after his death. What's that film about? And when did he begin it?
Question.
Why did it take so long to be finished?
Well, it's about an older director at the end of his career, and Peter Bogdanovich plays a young director, and John Huston plays the older director. People contend it's autobiographical. Well, Wells at the time said that it wasn't.
Well, he was using real people who probably were going through similar experiences.
Yes, yes. Wells was kind of the inventor of meta, and or maybe, who knows, the ancient Greeks were, I don't know, but he was doing a lot of meta twists in that film.
So how did it come to be finished? Who worked on it?
Well, it went on for years. In fact, after he died, his memorial service, I had to edit 3 minutes of it together. There were cutaways that were done 5 years apart. I mean, it was the look of it was all over the place. Only through
he didn't do it with Betacam, did he?
No. He did it on film, but the problem was he did it in different times. He did it with different film stocks. Only through digital technology in recent time could they make it anything.
And the biggest problem with it was that the film was initially financed by the Pahlavi family, the Shah of Iran's family, and when the Ayatollah took over, it was seized as part of his estate, and was put in a vault in France. And Wells, for years, was fighting to get the footage back. And then ultimately, when an agreement was come to, they were able to between I think Beatrice Wells, Oya Kodar, and whatever that company was that was financed by the Shah, they were able to get the footage out and begin this project on Netflix of trying to get this labyrinthine film put together and put on Netflix.
But we don't know that this was Wells' film. And I think that's an important thing that people say it's his last film. He didn't do it. It was done by others. And I looked at that film and I swore it couldn't be done. John Huston was asked to finish it. He refused because he didn't think it could be done. So, there was another film that was done when he went to Latin America during Amberson. It's All True. And it was never the original Wells film. It was just parts of it.
However, though, I don't think that they were entirely flying blind, because Bogdanovich, who had was in it and had talked for hours and hours with Wells about it, I believe had some role in it. But again, unless it was Wells editing it, it'd be hard to get what he imagined.
Okay, well, what about this play? We're pretty much out of time, but it's only scheduled to run at the Connolly Theater at 220 East 4th Street in the East Village until March 2nd. Any plans to take it to other venues?
Well, I'll say this. I think George plays Orson Welles better than any actor I've ever seen. And I predict that he'll be doing a film or he'll take it other places. I really mean that, because having known Welles, I tell you, he actually scares me sometimes. So I do believe it'll have a future life, and certainly at George is playing Orson. I don't know about the play as it is now. But I hope people will come see it.
Thanks,
like that
pal.
In the work?
Pardon?
Is a project like that in the work?
No, we're just trying to focus on finishing up very strong with what we're doing right now.
Well, thank you both so much for being on our show, Frank Beecham and George Dimas.
Can I plug the site for tickets?
Oh, please.
MaverickThePlay.com. MaverickThePlay.com.
Well, that's easy enough to remember.
Yes.
MaverickThePlay is one word.
Correct.
.com.
Yes.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Frank Beecham and George Dimas, to Barbara Kahn, who produced the segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.